Hello and welcome to the Illinois Radio Reader. I'm Janelle Eckerman, and today I'll be reading for you a selection of articles from the News Gazette for Friday, May 22, 2026. And the first article from the front page is from the University of Illinois, and the title is Consultant Maps Out Search for President. Application period to open in mid-July, and it's written by Luke Taylor. Urbana. The committee that will select the next president for the University of Illinois system met Friday to discuss what the steps of that process actually are. While current president Tim Colleen is set to stay in that role until his contract is up in June 2027, parts of the search process are expected to move relatively quickly. The period in which the committee officially accepts nominations will open in mid-July, certainly by July 20, officials said. That window will remain open until the beginning of September, likely around Labor Day. AGB Search, a firm that exclusively serves higher education institutions, has been selected to work with the UI committee on this process, and the article is then continued onto page A12. The firm was founded by the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges and includes professionals who were once in leadership roles at those institutions as search consultants. Sally Mason, a former president of the University of Iowa, now serves as a consultant who will be working with the UI. She led a good deal of Thursday's meeting outlining the process going forward. The search is launched on July 20th and we have a search committee meeting 10 days later, Mason said. I can guarantee you will have applications. They might not be good applications. Still, that meeting will be a chance for committee members to learn how to look at the portal and start understanding what they'll be sorting through, she said. Mason also said to expect plenty of applicants squeezing in just before the deadline and to be prepared to choose a pool to bring in for interviews rather quickly. Once those selections are made, likely sometime in September, she said the interviews will be held quickly too, likely as virtual meetings with the committee. That will begin the process of narrowing down a field of candidates. After that, Mason said, further dates are harder to determine because it's so far out and interview scheduling will require working with the applicants. Before any of this interview process can take place, the committee will have to form a profile of what the ideal choice for the next president will look like. Jamie Painter, UI System Senior Associate Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer, said that her department will create an outline of the formal job responsibilities and description. The UI Board of Trustees already put forth some ideal traits, including system leadership, strategic alignment, and resource stewardship, among many others that Board Chair Jesse Ruiz shared with the committee. Leading to the search period, AGB Search will host a number of town halls at each UI campus for anyone with ties to the universities to share their own perspectives and hopes for the next president. That's really kicking off the process of what we call listening sessions, Mason said. We're going to be talking to lots of people to get input to make certain that we have a good sense as we put this perspective together of what you all want to see in this next year for this great set of institutions. Those town halls are scheduled in June. The firm will be at the Chicago campus on June 16, Springfield on June 17, and Urbana-Champaign on June 18. And moving on, the next article from the front page is from around the area, Fisher Development, and the title is Subdivision Aims to Have Lots Ready in June. Home size limits will be established, construction deadlines also to be set, and it's written by Jana Wiesema. Fisher. Mark and Shana Horton see Fisher as the Mayberry of Champaign County. Fittingly, the couple wouldn't be out of place in the cast of the Andy Griffith Show, a farmer in a small town whose wife is the owner of the Rural Rose flower shop and boutique downtown. Since moving to the village in 2002, the Hortons have raised their kids in the community and seen their beloved Mayberry grow. However, they felt that there was something missing in the local housing market. One thing we were short of is some bigger homes for people that wanted a little more space, Horton said. Now, after years of planning, the couple has begun developing the 33-lot Centennial Acres subdivision on 40 acres at the northeast corner of Hamilton Street and County Road 600 East. And the article is then continued onto page A12. The first portion of the three-phase project is currently underway and encompasses six 0.6-acre lots that are expected to be available in June, Horton said. The subdivision will include 20 one-acre lots and 13 0.6-acre lots in total, as well as a two-acre private lake. Phase one began about a month ago. They're busy and they've put in sewer lines already, Horton said, and they're working on water lines right now and storm drainage and elevation. And the lake is working out really nicely because we needed a lot of soil to raise the southern part of the tract. It's very low. Phase two, planned for later this year, will focus on 11 one-acre lots on the west half of the subdivision. Individuals who buy lots in Centennial Acres will have a deadline to build their homes in order to prevent speculative buying, Horton said. There will also be a homeowners association and requirements for home sizes. We've had several Fisher residents express interest in buying a lot, he said. We've met with a few home builders. Lots are not priced yet. The project has been a long time coming. The Hortons bought most of the land in 2015 from owners who also had planned to sell large residential lots. We got the blueprints and bought everything with it, he said, and then we had it re-engineered maybe 5 years later to a different design, and this is actually the third concept. He estimated that the total project cost is about $3 million. Fisher National Bank has provided financing. The Farnsworth Group did the engineering and Bowood Brothers Farm and Excavating LLC is the contractor. Horton noted that the land is located in a new tax increment financing district. A project like this would be too risky without the benefits of a TIF district when you do the math, he said. Debbie Est, a village trustee who serves as finance and TIF district director, said the village has signed a $3 million redevelopment agreement with the Hortons, who will essentially get all of their development costs back over the life of the TIF, which is a little over 20 years. According to S, the agreement covers costs such as property acquisition, site preparation, legal expenses, engineering, public infrastructure and utility extensions, and one-third of the interest on the project loan. They are responsible for all the costs up front and they are reimbursed over the life of the TIF, which expires in 2049. They are reimbursed at an annual rate, receive 70% of property tax revenue within their subdivision, she said. The way a TIF works, it's all at the end of the rainbow, Horton said. The village has based its projected reimbursement on the assumption that homes in the subdivision, once built, will be valued at approximately $400,000 to $500,000, S said. The lots are a lot larger than a normal lot in the village of Fisher, she noted. The views are country living, but also in the village, so that's kind of unique. And we're really excited for them to get started and to partner with them on it. Mayor Mike Baylor said that the new subdivision will be another nice addition to Fisher. As a village, we've been growing since about 2000, he said. I credit this to the board looking ahead and also the creation of our first TIF district to help spur growth and development. I think since 2000, there have been over 230 homes built. Our population in 2000 was around 1,650 residents, and as of last census, we are close to 2,100 now. And with this article, there are three photos, and the first one is captioned, Construction on Phase 1 of the Centennial Acres subdivision got underway in April. The project is located at the northeast corner of Hamilton Street and County Road 600 East in Fisher. And that photo was courtesy of Boward Brothers Farm and Excavating. And the next photo is captioned, Construction on Phase 1 of the Centennial Acres subdivision got underway in April. The project is located at the northeast corner of Hamilton Street and County Road 600 East in Fisher. And the last photo is of excavation being done on the project. And finally, from the front page, there is a very large photo and it's captioned, From the High School Commencement, Parting Words. High school graduation season at State Farm Centre kicked off Thursday night with members of Urbana's class of 2026 receiving their diplomas. Next up, at the home of the Illini, Mahomet, Seymour tonight, and a Central Centennial doubleheader Tuesday. And from page A5, there are more photos of this event. And the main caption with these photos is, It was tassel turning time Thursday night at State Farm Centre, where members of Urbana High School's class of 2026 received their diplomas. And those photos were courtesy of Catherine Tellez Photos. Congratulations to all of those students on a great achievement. And moving on to page A2, first up in Daybook is Top of the Morning. Something to get you going today, courtesy of staff writer Luke Taylor. Bellying up with, on Fridays we'll spotlight the men and women serving up cold ones and conversation in our neck of the woods. Let us know about your favourite bartender by emailing ltaylor@news-gazette.com. Yesterday, Champaign County folks had a chance to pick up poppies for the American Legion's annual fundraiser ahead of Memorial Day. But for Jessica Swanson Bonner, the Legion is home year-round. She's been a bartender at Post 71 in Urbana for 21 years now. It creates a lot of friendships, a lot of people you get to know pretty well, Bonner said. At the Legion, we get to help people, the veterans especially. You get to assist with just making their day. Bonner said to come by the Legion to enjoy a happy environment, but bartending is only part of her role there. She's also involved in the Legion's work in the community and says her favourite memories are from helping a hand out snacks at the Special Olympics each year. Being involved in the community is a major part of what makes working at the Legion great, she said, from supporting youth sports and education to gathering supplies for unhoused veterans. If she's not working at the bar or otherwise helping out at Post 71, you'll find Bonner with her husband or kids, the youngest of whom just graduated from high school. And in corrections, the News Gazette strives to present fair and accurate reporting and to correct any errors as promptly as possible. Corrections and clarifications for all sections run on this page. To report an error, please call 217 351 5252, then press 6 to reach the newsroom. And from the Daybook, The Almanac. There are 223 days left in the year, and notable birthdays today are actor-filmmaker Richard Benjamin is 88, songwriter Bernie Taupin is 76, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is 69, singer Morrissey is 67, singer Johnny Gill, New Edition, is 60, actor Brooke Smith is 59, model Naomi Campbell is 56, actor Sean Gunn is 52, actor Jennifer Goodwin is 48, and actor Maggie Q is 47. Olympic speed skating gold medalist Apollo Anton Ono is 44, tennis player Novak Djokovic is 39, actor Judah Lewis is 25, and actor Peyton Elizabeth Lee is 22. And in area history on this day, in 1926, more streets in Urbana are now paved, with the completion of slab work on all Urbana pavement jobs at hand. The finished work includes North Busey Avenue, a block on Springfield Avenue between Kohler and Busey Avenues, and the entire Southwestern Improvement Program, which includes South Busey, Orchard, Delaware, and Vermont. The laying of sidewalks comes next. and in 1976, an informal meeting about the proposed widening and improvement of West Springfield Avenue between Mattis Avenue and Holiday Park Drive will be held. IDOT plans to provide four lanes of traffic and a left-turn lane. Holiday Park Drive was an extension of Kenwood Road, north of Springfield Avenue. And in 2011, Urbana City officials are hoping a $7.3 million beautification project will make the Boneyard Creek, and by association, the surrounding business district, more inviting for pedestrians within the next few years. Right now, a lot of people don't even know the creek exists because it's so carefully hidden, Urbana civil engineer Brad Bennett said, and that is no mistake. Historically, the city has not wanted people to get near the creek because of the safety risks it poses. And in international history, today's highlight. On May 22, 1960, the strongest earthquake recorded struck southern Chile. The magnitude 9.5 quake claimed 1,655 lives, left 2 million homeless, and triggered a tsunami responsible for over 230 additional deaths in Hawaii, Japan, and the Philippines. And in 1962, Continental Airlines Flight 11, en route from Chicago to Kansas City, Missouri, crashed near Unionville, Missouri, after a passenger ignited dynamite on board the plane, killing all 45 occupants of the Boeing 707. And in 1964, President Lyndon B. Johnson, speaking at the University of Michigan, outlined the goals of his great society, saying that it rests on abundance and liberty for all, and demands an end to poverty and racial injustice. And in 1969, the lunar module of Apollo 10 with Thomas P. Stafford and Eugene Cernan aboard flew within 9 miles of the moon's surface in a dress rehearsal for the first lunar landing. And finally, in 1985, U.S. sailor Michael L. Walker was arrested aboard the aircraft carrier Nimitz 2 days after his father, John A. Walker Jr., was apprehended by the FBI. Both were later convicted of spying for the Soviet Union. Michael Walker served 15 years in prison and was released in 2000. John Walker Jr. died in prison in 2014. I'll now move on to page A5 in today's reading of the News Gazette, and the article is Gibson City, Melvin Sibley, Darnell to retire as superintendent in 4 more years, and the article's written by Will Bromlevy. Gibson City. As Jeremy Darnell can attest, all good things indeed must come to an end. Darnell's tenure as the Gibson City Melvin Sibley School District's superintendent, dating back to July 1, 2016, will see that bittersweet moment in September 2030, per the terms of his final contract approved by the school board this week. Plenty of work remains, of course, before that life milestone arrives for Darnell, including leading the transition to his eventual successor, who might be selected from within GCMS's own ranks. There's a couple of folks who already have the superintendent's endorsement who are within our system, Darnell said. Obviously, there's a lot of water to flow under the bridge between now and then, but we will certainly have a transition plan. As part of Darnell's newly approved retirement contract, effective from July 1, 2026 through September 27, 2030, he will receive annual salary raises of 5% for year one and 6% for each of the next 3 years. Currently, his base salary is $178,000. Darnell replaced the retiring Anthony Galindo as superintendent in 2016, following a stint as principal of GCMS Middle School. Darnell said he feels fortunate to have held the district's top leadership post for so long. The average tenure of a superintendent in the state of Illinois is under 3 years, Darnell said. GCMS has had a long-standing investment into leadership, and I feel blessed to have been somebody to hold one of those roles. Under Darnell's leadership, the school district has done a good job of stewarding taxpayer dollars, maintaining a high trajectory for our district and finding subtle ways to continue to get a little better, he said. We're far from perfect, but we do things awfully well over here. Darnell said he is confident that trend will only continue under new leadership. At that point, I'll have been at GCMS for over 20 years and have served in the superintendency for almost 15, Darnell said. It's good to have fresh ideas and transition, and it's also really good to have a plan for it. So this gives us time to get everything kind of aligned and figure out what and who's next. And following on from page A5, the next article is from Salt Fork Schools, and the title is Storms New Court Honours Lou Hinkle. It's written by Jeff Delisio, Catlin. The home floor of Salt Fork Storm basketball will bear the name of a beloved assistant coach who was on the bench for the program's Lone State title and hundreds of other games. The school board this week unanimously signed off on making Lou Hinkle Court the new name of the high school gym floor, honouring the local legend who died in April at age 73. Members of Mr. Hinkle's family, including wife Laurie and daughter Lacey, were on hand for the vote. While Coach Hinkle loved the game and the community, his true passion was the student athletes, Salt Fork Superintendent Phil Cox said. It is impossible to fully measure the impact he had on generations of students in our district. We will forever remember his service, his dedication, his passion, his smile, and the lasting difference he made. Mr. Hinkle spent nearly 28 years under seven different head coaches as a boys' basketball assistant, first at Catlin High, then Salt Fork after the 1995 Catlin Jamaica Sports Co-op. That includes the 2009-2010 season, when the Storm captured the only basketball title in the history of Catlin, Jamaica, or Salt Fork. Despite a courageous battle with cancer that caused him to miss much of this past season, Cox said, Mr. Hinkle was back on the bench on senior night in February, embracing each senior as they left the floor. Cox said an official court dedication ceremony will be held prior to the 2026-2027 season. And with this article, there is a photo of Mr. Hinkle, and whose name will grace the gym floor at Salt Fork High School next season. I'll now include an article from page A8, which is entitled Memorial Day 2026. And the article is written by J. Mark Powell from Holy Cow History. And the title of the article is Memorial Day's Many Birthplaces. So you want to spend this Memorial Day in the town where the holiday began? Take your pick. After all, you have 25 communities to choose from. Experts will tell you that wading into identifying the town where Memorial Day started is a risky business. Call it the third rail of American history. Touching it can give researchers a serious jolt. Let's start with what we know for sure. Back in 1868, General John Blackjack Logan was Commander-in-Chief of the Grand Army of the Republic. It was an organization of Union Civil War veterans, much like today's American Legion and veterans of foreign wars. He urged that May 30 be observed as Decoration Day, a time to place flowers on the graves of Northern war dead. It's believed the 30th was selected because flowers would be blooming all around the country by then. A large ceremony was held that first Decoration Day at Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia, where future President James Garfield spoke for an hour and a half. Ulysses S. Grant, who would become president himself 10 months later, and much of the Union Army's big brass were also on hand. It was the first of Arlington's annual May observances honoring the fallen, a tradition that carries on to this day. But when you go back beyond 1868, things get very murky very fast. Claims of which community commenced the custom are frequent and intense. There's Columbus, Missouri, where on April 25, 1866, ladies laid flowers on the graves of Confederate soldiers killed in the nearby bloody Battle of Shiloh. Farther east, Columbus and Macon, Georgia, each say they got the ball rolling with observances. A cemetery in Carbondale, Logan's wartime home, contains a stone proclaiming the first Memorial Day observance was held there on April 29, 1866. Charleston, South Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, Bowlesburg, Pennsylvania, and many other localities all boast the honor as theirs. In 1966, Congress waded into the dispute by declaring Waterloo, New York, to be the holiday's official birthplace. Why Waterloo? It seems a special day of observance was held there on May 6, 1866. Stores were closed, flags were flown at half-staff, and, of course, graves were decorated with flowers. That, Waterloo's supporters argue, shows it was an organised, town-wide event. Incidents in other places, they say, were just ad hoc. Groups of women taking flowers to the local cemetery. Waterloo's observance had all the hallmarks of a true holiday, and Congress eventually agreed. But that didn't stop the bickering. In the 60 years since the official designation was bestowed, adherents of other towns' claims to the title keep arguing for a transfer. They'll likely still be arguing about it 60 years from now, too. There's even a separate debate over which town hosts the nation's oldest continuously running Memorial Day parade. Doylestown, Pennsylvania, has a parade that has been held since 1868. But the parade in Rochester, Wisconsin, started in 1867. It was worth noting that in spring 1917, just as America was entering World War I, the holiday's focus began shifting from decorating just Civil War graves to honoring everyone who fell in all American wars. After World War II, the name began changing from the quaint Decoration Day to Memorial Day. In 1968, Congress passed the Uniform Monday Holiday Act, both cementing the new name and moving its observance to the last Monday in May. One important parting note. At the conclusion of Arlington National Cemetery's first ceremony in 1868, children from the Soldiers and Sailors Orphans' Home walked among the rows of tombstones, singing hymns as they strewed flowers on all graves, both Union and Confederate. The very children who had lived through the war and lost their fathers in its carnage paid tribute to their parents' adversaries. Given how deeply and increasingly divided the country is in 2026, where people are all too eager to tear into anyone they disagree with or destroy anything they don't like, it would be well to visit 1868's example so that once more a little child shall lead them. And there are two photos with this article, and the first one is captioned, "Reenactors in Union Army uniforms march during a previous Memorial Day ceremony in Carbondale's Woodlawn Cemetery, which lays claim to hosting the first such ceremony on April 29, 1866. And the second photo is of the historical marker at the southwest corner of the cemetery, noting it as the site of the first Memorial Day ceremony. I'll now take a short break and return with part two of today's reading of selections from the News Gazette for Friday, May 22, 2026, read by Janelle Eckerman. Please stay tuned.